Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound, it's John Vocat, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you even more information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, we're going to open helping you equip yourself for the increased stress many of us seem to develop around the holidays, and we'll be providing some advice on how to mitigate that stress so you can fully enjoy the upcoming seasonal celebrations. We'll welcome an expert on the subject from St. Francis Hospital and Medical Center. Then we'll learn about the Community Fund for Women and Girls, a component of the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven and the second oldest women's endowment in the state of Connecticut. We'll key in on eight regional programs that have received more than $200,000 this year during the 20th anniversary of the fund. Then we're going to wrap up replaying an interview from earlier this year featuring friends from Connecticut Main Street talking about an innovative way for communities to promote business while taking it a little bit easier on taxpayers when it comes to developing commercial projects. We'll be talking about TIF, tax increment financing. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vocat, right after this news. Survive the Drive, our friends provide an independent nonprofit educational resource providing risk awareness, presentations, and hands-on defensive driver training to individuals, schools, and community groups. At Survive the Drive, staff and volunteers do everything they can to reach out to everyone, especially teens and novice drivers, to help reinforce basic safety and good driving behavior. Survive the Drive is in high schools, and last June, they initiated a behind-the-wheel, hands-on driver training program, all with the hope that the attention and focus will save a life or prevent a crash. Of course, these programs can't happen without your donations. If you'd like to help or request Survive the Drive training in your school or community group, just visit survivethedrive.org. All right. Well, I am feeling it. I am talking about holiday stress. That's right. Thanksgiving is still a few days away, and the other December holidays are scant weeks away, but I'm sure I'm not the only one that's already starting to feel a little bit stressed with the oncoming holiday season. So we decided, with the help of our friends at St. Francis in Hartford, to try to mitigate or at least address and learn a little bit about holiday stress. And as a result, we are making the acquaintance of a brand new friend on the award-winning For the People. Dr. Irfan Monoir is with us. Dr. Monoir completed his adult psychiatric residency at the University of Mississippi Medical Center in Jackson and finished his child and adolescent psychiatry fellowship at the University of Connecticut Health Center. So we welcome you, and thanks for being our newest and latest friend to the program, Dr. Monoir.
Thank you, Mr. Vocat. Thank you for the invitation.
I was going to ask you, you are as much a specialist with adults as there are children. Do adults experience a significantly different aspect of holiday stress than kids? Do adults worry about what they're going to find as a gift during the holiday season? What is the difference between the type of stress that a younger person may experience at the holiday than an adult?
Mr. Vocat, holiday is a time of stress. Well, let me start by saying this. Holiday is a time of joy, happiness, and it's a wonderful time of the year. People enjoy, people do happy things, people look forward to this time. However, it brings in stress for everyone. Whether you're a child, whether you're an adult, in some respect, it is going to be stressful for you. The 2011 Stress in America survey by the American Psychological Association found that 22% of Americans report an extreme levels of stress during the holiday season. And a similar survey in 2008 called the Holiday Stress Poll by the same organization showed that more than 8 out of the 10 Americans anticipate stress during the holiday season. So these are pretty high numbers and affecting, like I said earlier, every person in every walk of life. Children are stressed about the type of gifts they are going to get, how they are going to show off their gifts, or whether or not they're going to be able to show off their gifts to their friends. If their friend is getting some expensive gifts, and if they are not, that is going to be another level of stress. Stress can also come from financial problems, which although adults are faced with, however, these situations, these stressful situations, can trickle down from the adults to children, and there are many other factors which can lead to stress.
Yeah, I would imagine a child who's a little bit more mature or at a very impressionable age, when they start hearing from the backseat of the car in the next room, a parent or parents haranguing or worrying about the fact that they don't have enough money to get the kids' presents, then the kids start feeling a little bit responsible. They want to do something, sort of that stress by association has got to be prevalent.
Absolutely, and it is not just ending there. Then the anticipation of these parties, get together, and meeting people who they have not seen, for example, maybe the whole year, just that anticipation in itself can lead to significant stress, especially if they were not relating properly to these other individuals. Could be their cousins, could be their friends, could be other family members. So it brings us to something very important, that what has changed in that last Thanksgiving or a last holiday. Somebody could have been in a divorce situation, family could have separated, there could be a death in the family. All these factors will be highlighted during this holiday season and will lead to further problems.
Mm. Well, I have to say, probably in the past 30 or 40 years, Hollywood has made billions and billions of dollars developing films, putting an interesting cast of characters together in a number of different situations surrounding the holiday period, and highlighting and reinforcing the kinds of incredible conflicts and problems that those relationships bear. I'm interested in your opinion as to how much of the way the media is broadcasting information and programming now about the holidays, that plays a role. I mean, I'm in my mid-50s. When I was a child at holiday time, it did seem to be a much more quiet and less stressful period. Folks were focusing on the wonder and joy and the true spirit of the holiday season, where today it just not so much.
Well said, Mr. Wockett. The media is playing both a positive role and a more stressful role as well. So, for example, if we look at the extensive advertisement which is being done on the media about different types of gifts, what people should buy, what people should not buy, and this oftentimes sets a very high bar to what type of a gift it has to be, and certainly adds to a very significant level of stress to families who have financial problems. And similarly, all these different movies may set in some unrealistic expectations of the what really holiday season is about, and it is very easy to get diverted away from the actual message of the holiday season, that it is all about family, it is all about getting together and having a great celebration with loved ones, and not to be worrying about the gifts, and also not to be worrying about the elaborate decorations and gourmet food and what type of gifts and presents are being brought in. So in some ways, I agree with you that it is taking away the whole message about the holiday season.
Mm. Do you find, either through your practical experience or professional experience, that there are certain cultural predispositions that actually or traditions that help to address and mitigate stress? Or are there certain cultures that don't really seem to have this kind of stress at the holiday season?
I think all cultures are equally affected. Whoever is celebrating these holidays, and in America everybody is, it certainly brings in some degree of stress, and the only best way is to follow a certain guideline, certain tips to make sure that the stress level is handled in a much better fashion. And certainly, as we go forward in the program, we'll talk more about that.
Yeah, and before we review the tips, I think it's most important for you as an authority and a psychiatrist to stress to people how worrying and stressing over the holidays doesn't just affect your mental health.
There can be
physical fallout as a result of constant extreme stress, especially at this time of year.
Absolutely. So our immune system, stress level, they all are very well connected. Very high levels of and significant levels of the holiday stress can certainly lead to a fallout on our physical health as well. With the amount of spent for shopping, going online, spending hours and hours after on these websites, or if somebody is going to the mall and ignoring their health, not eating properly, not eating on time, not exercising, all these factors can certainly contribute. And just the season itself is changing. There's a change in the time. The flu season is also setting in around this type of the year. So all these factors can lead to a decrease in the defense mechanisms we have, and we can certainly have not only the fallout in our mental health, but also in physical health as well.
Well, we've learned from a release with the American Psychological Association that unless you already have developed a very effective relaxation and self-love techniques, like positive self-talk, that there may be a much greater likelihood that you're going to respond to stress through things like overeating or overindulging in alcohol or other intoxicating substances, having arguments, not exercising or getting enough sleep. So we want to review a number of tips that are being provided by the APA. And the first, of course, is catching yourself and taking a break, perhaps as often as maybe every hour, to even take a minute or two to take a breath and relax and kind of get inside your own head and help reinforce that you need to take it easy.
Absolutely, and I would describe this as taking time for yourself, taking good care of yourself, regular exercise, taking a long walk to decompress yourself in this stressful time, eating a healthy meal, a balanced meal, and very, very importantly, taking a very good sleep every night so that you are refreshed every morning and ready for the day. So in addition to that, other things which are very, very critical are setting up realistic expectations among all your family members, with your children, with your parents, with your other friends, so that everybody is very well aware of. For example, if a child has a wish list and having a very good conversation, explaining to the child about the budget, about finances, talking to them regarding what is expected and what family can afford and what may not be able to, that may help with setting up a proper level of expectation and may help in reducing the stress, actually, and may bring in more peace and harmony to this holiday season.
It's also supposed to be the season of love, but so often there's so much stress, we find ourselves arguing with and worse with the people that we should love the most. I guess part of one of the therapies for de-stressing during the holiday season is finding a way to look at your loved ones in a different way and having appreciation and empathy for their stress as well.
Absolutely, and seeking support in this time of the year is the best way to do. I would not just say that you want to seek support only from your therapist or a counselor. I would say you also want to extend your hand and get support from your other family members, including your children in it is very, very critical. Whenever you include children in these stressful times and explain them how things are going and help them along. This helps you in return. And similarly, if you have a good relationship with your parents as young adults, this may help you bring in even more support in addition to whatever else a person is doing. In addition to that, there are several other organizations out there which are very willing to provide extra support and help during this very difficult time. For example, for those individuals who are struggling with alcohol addiction, holiday stress can lead to relapses in their addiction, and seeking support from AA, for example, Alcoholic Anonymous, which is running meetings around the holiday season, especially when it gets closer to the Christmas and the New Year. They are doing meetings 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and probably the only organization which is doing that. So seeking support from AA can be very critical and helpful in this stressful time.
Yeah, or I suppose any of a number of other 12-step initiatives, depending on what the issue may be.
Absolutely, absolutely. And and another note, those individuals, for example, who have issues related to depression and anxiety, for example, especially for depression, using light therapy can be very critical and helpful in controlling and helping them with their depression, and may reduce the stress level which they're having and may keep their thoughts together and bring them more harmony. And similarly, another special situation, for example, social anxiety disorder, having a proper discussion, knowing who are the family members will be coming, how large the party will be, who is going to be their support, if they're getting very anxious in this very crowded social situation, may be very helpful and may help them handle the gatherings and parties around this holiday season in a much better way. In a similar fashion, another important tip can also be to do more of your shopping online than going to the malls, which can be a very anxiety-provoking for many individuals with social anxiety especially.
Very good. In the last couple minutes that we have with you, Dr. Munawar, we know getting exercise, not running away from it, but running into exercise is important. Getting the right amount of sleep, even though there aren't enough hours in the day to get through all of our responsibilities, as well as preparation and interacting at holiday time. But something else I'd like you to speak to, and that is the effect that the kind of foods that we're exposed to could have on the level of stress we're feeling. If I understand correctly, there are actually the right and wrong kinds of foods you might be able to be eating at holiday events or at home that could make a difference.
Absolutely. So, for example, if we are looking at a person with alcohol addiction, making sure that the family members are respectful to the type of food being on the table, considering the alcohol addiction of a particular person in the family. So that means no wine on the table. That means no food should be cooked with alcohol. Similarly, someone with diabetes, for example, should also be respected, and food cooked should be appropriate to the condition of the person. This will definitely will lead to reduction in the stress. And on that note, I also want to add that it is very, very critical and important that these gatherings and events should be planned together with the family, with the extended family being involved, so that everybody is very well aware of that how the party is being planned, what to expect, so that when family members are together, there are no surprises, and everybody is feeling comfortable because everybody was involved and their opinion and their concerns were well heard of.
Excellent. Well, thanks to our guest this morning, Dr. Irfan Munawar from St. Francis. We are much better equipped to be dealing with the holiday stress. Dr. Munawar, I'm feeling better already, and I want to thank you so much for being part of the program this morning. So a little over a month ago, or around a month ago, on October 30th, at the 20th anniversary celebration of luncheon, the Community Fund for Women and Girls, Greater New Haven's permanent charitable endowment dedicated solely to advancing women and girls, announced that it has awarded $203,000+ in grants to 8 nonprofit organizations serving women and girls in Greater New Haven and the Naugatuck Valley area. We are pleased to welcome to the program this morning another new friend from the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven. We're talking with Sharon Capetta. She's Director of Development and Lead Staff for the Community Fund for Women and Girls, as we chatted just a few minutes before we went on the air. Sharon indicated that she's been involved with the fund for a little over a dozen years of its 20 years of existence. So we want to find all about it and celebrate the those agencies and programs that were awarded through this initiative. Sharon, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning, John. Thank you for having us.
So just give us a little bit of history and perspective. First of all, a little bit about the mission of the Community Foundation and its desire to impact resources for philanthropy and kind of enhancing the knowledge of and practice of philanthropy in your service area?
Oh, great question. Yeah, the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven is one of the older community foundations in the country, and there are over 600 community foundations in our country. And it's a public charitable endowment, and it's composed of individuals and create charitable funds, typically through requests or active giving, and they create funds to carry out their philanthropic wishes and intent. And they charge the Community Foundation with honoring that intent forever. So that's really the focus on the fund side of honoring the donor's intent. The Fund for Women and Girls, which is also a component fund of the Community Foundation, is a collective one. 20 years ago, a woman came to the Community Foundation and said she wanted to do something to help women and girls and children, and what might work for that purpose. And at the time, women's funds, collective endowment funds, were being created across the country. So she had the option of making it a collective effort or simply creating her own fund and making recommendations for grants herself. And she opted for the collective model, and the Fund for Women and Girls was born. So the fund itself is governed by an advisory board of women who determine strategy, purpose, focus, that type of thing. And the grants are recommended by also by committee and then approved ultimately by the Community Foundation Board of Directors.
So for the, you know, two or three times a year, we check in with community foundations, including the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven and the Valley Community Foundation. We hear about how the power of many underwrites initiatives, most of the time ongoing. What I found really special about your explanation and what I know of the Fund for Women and Girls is it really reinforces the fact that one person's philanthropy can plant a seed that really can begin to make a substantial difference, not just in one community, but an entire region or even perhaps statewide. And this Fund for Women and Girls is certainly evidence of, you know, how one person's effort can really make a long-term difference.
It's funny. It's wonderful that you've picked up on that. And In working on this 20th anniversary, spent a lot of time. There were two women and a small group of women who said, "Yeah, let's create this collective fund. Let's build it together." And they set a goal to raise $10,000, and they hoped that 10 women would make a commitment of $1,000 to be paid over 4 years to get this fledgling fund off the ground. And in 1995, $1,000 was a large commitment. And they were delighted when they did not only 10,000, not only 10 women came forward and said, yes, I'm in. Actually, 92 women said, I'm in, count me in.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an incredible response to this idea that an endowment fund, growing an endowment fund, stepping forward and saying, this is a priority, a philanthropic priority. Advancing women and girls is important, and count me in. And so this starting 20 years ago, this power of many, as you mentioned. And in the early years of the fund, I mean, the first grant awards from the fund in 1996 totaled $1,500. But none of the people around the table were in the habit of writing $1,500 checks for philanthropy, for directed to organizations. And it was delightful and really a privilege to sit with the founding members and share with them that in the 20th year, the fund would commit over $200,000 in grants that year. So tremendous trajectory of growth because of the many, many people that have supported it over the years.
Yeah, the other cool thing is that it reminds people that if they have a particular passion or a particular concern, even a highly niche concern, I mean, if you want to start a fund that's potentially going to target, Native American children who live in the urban New Haven region who are having, issues with dyslexia or autism, you could potentially go to the community foundation and work to try to establish that highly niche initiative, and then perhaps align some of your friends or colleagues around it to start the ball rolling, just like this fund. So anybody who has a dream about carrying on their passion long after they are gone has an opportunity to do that with the foundation.
Yes, that's true. The value of the Community Foundation is helping people think today about their philanthropic intent 50 or 100 years from now. And my favorite example is a fund that was established in the 50s, the late 40s, early 50s, for the provision of milk and coal for the poor among us. And so if the intent over time, certainly coal is no longer used for heating, and the milk delivery system through the public schools and the federal programs is such that when the fund was created, kids didn't have milk and people didn't have coal to heat with. In the contemporary version, those funds are used to provide what we call basic needs, so the heating and energy assistance programs that are done through various organizations in the region, and the food distribution programs as well. So that's the beauty of the Community Foundation, is that 60, 80, 100 years from now, that intent, that provision of basic needs for the poor among us, is being met. It allows it to stay contemporary.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that is not beyond the reach of virtually anyone. I think a lot of times people are confused or aren't aware that even if they have a very nominal amount to invest, if they they've decided I'm going to spend $100 or $1,000 a year, and I want to make it quick and easy, I want it to go one place, and I want it to know that it's going to work well for the community or toward my passion, and I'd like an opportunity for that money to perhaps grow in concert with other like-minded donors. It doesn't have to be $1,000,000 or $100,000 or even $10,000. It can be a quite a nominal sum, and I know that represents perhaps a growing segment of the donors to the Community Foundation.
Yeah, you could say that, as you mentioned before, with these the power of many. So reaching together, gathering together and pooling resources in these collective funds like the Fund for Women and Girls allows a more modest donor to have great impact, to share in the great impact.
Mm. That's great. We're going to also talk about how some of the recipients of this year's Fund for Women and Girls grants actually are working together to make their initiative stronger. We're pleased to be joined this morning by a representative of the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven, Sharon Capetta, Director of Development and Lead Staff for the Community Fund for Women and Girls. We're going to come back after a brief break and drill into celebrating some of all of the 8 recipients of this year's grants. If you'll stick with us through the break, we'll be right back. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this zoo news. Yes, there's always something wild going on at Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo, and you can get in the holiday spirit and join Frosty and his friends for breakfast at the zoo. Characters will be available for photo ops and breakfast will be served. Event dates are being scheduled between December 5th and 20th from 9 to 11 a.m. But reservations are required. The cost is $10 per person for zoo members and $15 for non-members. The price includes zoo admission, photo ops, and breakfast. You can call 203-394-6574 for more information or for all of the other seasonal activities and all the great activities going on at Connecticut's only zoo. Just visit them at beardsleyzoo.org. Thanks for sticking with us. We're back with Sharon Capetta. She represents the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven this morning. She is a director of development and lead staff for the Community Fund for Women and Girls. As we said before, Sharon joined us at its 20th anniversary celebration in late October. The Fund for Women and Girls and the Greater awarded $203,740 in grants to 8 nonprofit organizations serving women and girls in Greater New Haven and the Naugatuck Valley. So, Sharon, the first thing I want to talk about is something that was kind of pulled out by one of the fund's advisory board members, Nancy Yao Mosbach, indicating how proud she was that not only were these grants going to good causes in some cases, or perhaps all of them, they were going to causes that have some interconnectivity or cooperative nature. Can we talk a little bit about that before we reveal the 8 grant recipients?
Sure. The Fund for Women and Girls looks at the all of the partners, if you will. We the advisory board and grants committee, view the nonprofit organizations as partners in this work, and they're all connected by the link to gender, in that they are all looking to provide programming and services that will promote the social and economic advancement of women and girls. So that's the mission of the fund. And working at this in a very thoughtful way, and we are delighted to have partnership with many, many organizations in the region that are thinking about issues and opportunities for women and girls.
Excellent. And I'm pleased that at least 7 of the 8 of this year's recipients have either been one time or even repetitive guests on the award-winning For the People with me, or we've certainly talked about them and helped promote them through public service announcements. So let's introduce the 2015 grant recipients for the Fund for Women and Girls, starting with the big money, the $160,000 signature grant going to All Our Kin. Let's hear about that organization.
Well, All Our Kin is a truly terrific organization that works with family child care providers. And family child care providers are doing the bulk of child care provision. And All Our Kin focuses actually on areas that where you're working with what you call, say, an underserved population. So they are increasing and improving the quality, the amount of child care available, the quality of the child care available, and they, in the process, are developing women business entrepreneurs as family child care providers. So So we've been delighted to work with all our kin over the years, over 12 years actually, in the growth and development of their organization. This grant specifically is to provide one-on-one coaching and consultation around the business aspect of being a family child care provider. And they have done evaluation of their program, and the economic impact is just, it's truly amazing how family child care providers who are involved with all our kin and members of their network advance their businesses, the quality of the care that they're providing, and the continuity. And it's also important. We've well documented the link between early care and education and later outcomes and achievement in life. So people are able to have their children in a quality, loving, successful, consistent child care provider as a result. So it just works on so many levels.
Mm. We talk a lot about the Girl Scouts of Connecticut. They were a $5,000 grantee. And what's exciting about just this kind of nominal grant to this organization is that it is going to go toward establishing a pilot program.
Yeah, the Girl Scouts of Connecticut, which covers the whole state now, had started doing a little bit of work in Bridgeport in working to ensure that girls have access to troops. And of course, dynamics and demographics are changing in our world, so they're testing different ways to ensure that troops are available, particularly in some of our more concentrated urban areas. So we're delighted that they are piloting their program in New Haven, and we look forward to a successful report with them and see how we can continue that work. We all know that Girl Scouting is important.
And this is evidence of the kind of crossover effect, because that pilot program is going to be initiated in partnership with the Boys and Girls Club of New Haven themselves, a $10,000 grantee. And once again, to evidence that kind of community spirit, the $10,000 for the Boys and Girls Club of New Haven separately is going to support a new program called Ascend, which is being promoted in cooperation with Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The Boys and Girls Club is another organization that we are just truly privileged to partner with. And specifically, interested in and delighted that they continue to find ways to, you know, in addition to the Boys and Girls Club's fully vetted programming, the partnership and mentorship opportunities with the AKAs, the Alpha Kappa Alpha, which is an African American women's sorority, really just, you know, imagine that you're a 12-year-old girl and you have the chance to partner with and learn from and develop a career and college readiness information with a practiced, real life, if you can see it, you can be it, woman who is in the Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority. So it just really makes complete sense.
Excellent. Our friends at the Connecticut Women's Education and Legal Fund were a $2,500 recipient at the end of October for this event. And this is focusing on an important initiative that we can't talk enough about, and that is reinforcing STEM education, especially for girls and women.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's interesting because QWELF, we affectionately refer to the Connecticut Women's Education and Legal Fund as QWELF. You wouldn't think from their name, the Education and Legal Fund, that they would be so actively working on STEM programming, but they actually do tremendous work all around the state in partnership with institutions such as Gateway. So we're delighted to support their work.
Yeah. And another recipient also focusing on STEM education, this time in kind of a more fun way, a girls-only summer program, are our friends at LEAP, who received $10,000. So this sounds like a lot of fun for girls ages 7 to 12, and a great way to perhaps reveal to them a future career in one of the STEM disciplines.
Exactly. We were delighted when the local paper carried a front page story entitled Girls Code, because it was about coding and also the swimming piece, making sure that the girls know how to swim is really important. But the coding and making it fun and planting that seed that you can do that too. Mm-hmm. Marries well with the Boys and Girls Club program. If you can see it, you can be it. And having the opportunity to do that in an environment full of other girls is truly something that we look to support.
Great. Two other organizations now, as the spotlight swings toward Milford, are some spectacular initiatives, both who have been frequent guests or been frequently promoted on For the People over many years. Literacy Center of Milford receiving $5,000 specifically to support an adult women's English as a Second Language program and mother's advanced class serving immigrant women in the community. And the Young Parent Program, which focuses on ensuring teens and young adults who are expecting can attend childbirth classes and get positive pregnancy counseling. And it carries on after the baby is born with support to ensure that that family grows in a great way. Both great organizations, the Young Parent Program receiving $2,500 for their efforts. And last but not least, the final awardee for the Women and Girls Fund this year, Pequeñas Ligas Hispanas de New Haven, who received the curiously not round figure of $8,740. It sounds like an invoice was presented. What's going on with this one?
Pequeñas Ligas is really the fundamentals of sports and with a focus on girls is really important, but it's also about college readiness and enhancing the attractiveness of Latina candidates for college admission. So it's a very interesting program and very detailed. So that's the $8,740.
Excellent. That's
a very precise application.
They could pin it down. Hey, and that makes it easier on the grantors to know that they're targeting the exact amount of money that's needed for the program. So that's great.
Yeah.
Well, we thank you for being with us this morning. It was great to be able to chat about this fantastic initiative. Sharon Capetta, Director of Development and Lead Staff for the Community Fund for Women and Girls, is with us. That program is a component of the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven and the second oldest women's endowment in the state of Connecticut. To date, it has awarded approximately $1 million to support more than 200 programs since its establishment 20 years ago. If you're interested in finding out more about this or other initiatives of the foundation, you can always go to fundforwomenandgirls.org or visit cfgnh.org for the larger community foundation programs, which are always happening. We thank you for filling us in on this latest round of grants for the Fund for Women and Girls, and wish you good luck and a happy holiday, Sharon. Well, now we are going to talk TIF. With the unanimous passage of expanded tax increment financing, or TIF, legislation in 2015, Connecticut has a new tool for economic growth. And we are here to talk with one of the agencies that is teaching municipalities about how to use TIF. John Simone is president and CEO of Connecticut Main Street, an organization that's a long and dear friend of ours here at the award-winning For the People, and we're glad to have you back and to meet you, John. Thanks for getting in with us this morning.
Well, I appreciate being invited to spend some minutes with you.
So, first of all, let's go back to before the inception of this legislation, when we had an absence of tax increment financing. What were communities doing at that point? What were communities prevented from doing at that point that TIF now allows them to do to enhance infrastructure development and redevelopment opportunities?
I'll give you a quick short answer and then a little bit more expanded answer. The short answer is it didn't allow communities to take the increased value from future tax revenues to pay for investments you make today. So what that means is if you're trying to invest in a current economic development project, you have to find current revenue to do that. And in an era when the government's revenues are shrinking, that's a hard thing to do. But if you don't mind, I'll quickly expand on what I mean by that.
Oh, please.
But the whole thing for us went back to there's been this wonderful pendulum swinging back from the era of single-use car-oriented development to people wanting to live and work in downtowns in walkable, mixed-use atmospheres. That's the good news. So there's this growing demand, and particularly among old and aging people who are, there's more of us in Connecticut than ever, and the young millennials we want to keep. But we don't have the supply of housing. We have the physical space, but the ability to make the kind of mixed-use development, especially in older buildings where you're rehabilitating them into upper floor apartments over commercial space, is really the hardest kind of economic deal to do. I call it a lost art form. So while we have this great demand for people who want to live downtown, we don't have the supply. So we hooked up with the Connecticut Housing Finance Authority to develop this pilot program called Come Home to Downtown, where we've been now, we've had seven different pilots where we're helping both the municipalities and the building owners learn how to do this kind of development. And we learned pretty quickly that most of our downtowns have low market rents, which means that the income you can get out of a mixed-use development is low, which means the banks won't loan a lot of money, which means there's going to be a financial gap in these deals, and small property owners don't have the development experience, nor do the municipalities for this kind of development. So there's a lot of holes that we were trying to fill, and we learned by looking around where do we find new resources that one that was out there that our colleagues are using in other states is called tax increment financing districts. We have that law before in Connecticut, but it was only applicable to projects and not for an entire district like a downtown. And we felt that if we could do that, the increment taxes you would get, and the way it works fast, it's not an easy thing to get across, but if you, for example, if a town, I'll give you an example that happened in where I worked in Windsor on the Main Street program.
Sure.
There's a mill there that has sat empty for over 20 years, 80,000 square feet, and a developer wanted to put 50 condos into it. He had everything in place money-wise except for there was a gap he needed to fill of $800,000 for a brownfield that he needed to work on.
Sure.
And he went to the community, to the municipality, and they said, look, we're getting no taxes out of that empty mill. You're going to turn it into 50 units of condos, and we know that's going to produce a lot more taxes. We'll loan you the money, or actually give you the money, and we know we'll get it back on the increment taxes. It'll get paid when it's done, and that's exactly how it works. So, but for the tax increment financing investment made up front by the town of Windsor, this property would have never been redeveloped, and Windsor now has 50 units that are full of people living there and spending money there. But they're making way more than just the money they need to make back on the original $800,000. And we just wanted to see that expanded from just one project because most projects are small and you can't get enough impact to the whole district. And so that's the legislation that got passed through a great team of people, the Connecticut Council of American Planning Association, the Connecticut Economic Development Association, and the law firm of Pullman and Cunley and Connecticut Main Street Center. We all teamed together and did this based on research that we had done by the Yale Law School, where they not only researched we had these TIF laws in place here in Connecticut, but they were too project-specific and not district-related like we're just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But the better thing is they discovered other states where there are districts being developed and a lot of good work's being done. So we stole a lot of this from Maine and Iowa. In fact, tomorrow we have folks from Maine and Iowa coming in for our first workshop in helping communities learn how to actually implement this kind of a tool.
Right. And as folks know, we often tape these interviews ahead of the Sunday morning broadcast as to not drag you out of bed at 5:30 or 6 on a Sunday morning. And actually, as this airing, that workshop is over, but there's others that
That's
are
right.
being planned.
There are going to be more coming up, yep.
Yeah. But
the Connecticut Conference on Municipalities has one on October 20th. We're doing one at the Southern New England American Planning Association workshop on the 24th and 25th of September right here in Hartford. We're also doing one for the Connecticut Assessors Association Symposium. The assessors are really key key to this kind of tax increment financing on September 22nd. And we have a lot more we're planning out. There's a lot of education to do now, and we're excited about getting started on that.
Assessors are the foretellers of the increment.
That's correct. Exactly.
So so what do you, although you're sort of going to have to tell the future a little bit, what do you know about these Iowa and Maine projects that you hope to see transplanted in communities throughout Connecticut as a result of this TIF enablement?
They've produced a lot of development that otherwise would not have happened. It's a simple answer. In Maine, they actually now have... And Maine has got it's maybe a larger physical state, but it has less municipalities, I believe. Mm-hmm. There's 350 TIF districts in Maine that have produced all kinds of great information. Return on investment. By the way,
state,
all the stuff I just threw out at you can be accessed at our website, which is www.ctmainstreet.org, in terms of the upcoming events and or information, more information on TIFs.
Yeah, and while Maine is certainly a much bigger state than Connecticut, it has many of these villages and village-type situations that many of our small towns have.
Exactly, and the same is true with Iowa. A lot of small towns where they don't have a lot of resources, and these things have been able to help them, you know, generate development. And the important thing is it really can attract private and leverage private resources. That's what this is doing more than anything. It's setting the stage to attract the kind of investment you want. Right. And that's the other thing. It's all municipally determined. So it's the municipality that decides what does it want for its district and how they want to get there. And then they put the investment where they are going to leverage what they want to leverage in order to get where they want to go. So it's not being told from the outside what's going to come in. It's working from the inside out. It's community driven.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about that and how communities can get much more involved with Connecticut Main Street Center. John Simone is with us. He is the president and CEO of Connecticut Main Street Center, and we've got them for about another 3 or 4 minutes, so we want to tell everyone why they should be interested in Connecticut Main Street Center. It's not CMSC is not just for economic development wonks anymore. It's really has something for virtually everyone here in the state of Connecticut. So for folks for which that prior conversation about TIFs sort of sounded a little bit Greek, Let's give them an idea about what Connecticut Main Street Center offers to folks that don't have their finger on the pulse of economic development in their community.
Well, I think the best way to describe what we do best and how we can best help a community, we're again focused on downtowns or town centers, you know, districts and places. And to make those work, you really need to have some sort of a management entity overseeing that, which is coming out of a public and private partnership. The simple analogy is there's not a mall in this country that doesn't have a strong management component worrying 24/7 about how that mall works. You know, how is it clean? How are they marketing themselves? Making sure it's customer friendly? Do they have the right uses in the right places? Well, all that needs to happen, and it's quite frankly easier to do at a mall because it has one owner with total control. Whereas in a downtown, you have all these stakeholders involved, both property owners, business owners, the public sector, the community at large. You need some sort of an entity, this partnership, this downtown management entity that's going to bring all these people together and convene them to help them forge a common vision. And then what that also brings in is the capacity and political will to get things done, because it's the biggest problem with most of our communities is not the lack of plans. There's all kinds of plans out there, but the lack of ability to implement those plans. And that's what we try to bring to the table more than anything.
Yeah, it's interesting that you're kind of citing that mall analogy, which is something that was huge over the past 20 to 30 years, but is now sort of eclipsed by a move back towards city centers, and not just for businesses, but also for residences. And
that's
so
right.
Many of these city centers are now getting the idea that they need to make affordable places, especially for Connecticut's young people to live after they graduate from college. They may not want to come back home because there are no cool, hip places for them to live within the affordable range of a new job holder.
And let me just throw one stat to you, because it's pretty impressive. In communities that are trying to figure out how to grow their revenues but keep control of their expenses, Asheville, North Carolina did this, but it would work anywhere. They compared their downtown on a per acre basis to a big box development, a Walmart actually, it was just outside of downtown. And the property taxes paid to the town by the Walmart on a per acre basis was $6,500 per acre. Downtown was paying $365,000 per acre because of the density of the development. Retail sales tax, so you would expect that Walmart would be way ahead as the retail giant, but it was only half, $47,000 per acre versus $83,000. And probably the biggest eye-opener, jobs. Walmart, 5.9 jobs per acre. Downtown, 73.7 jobs per acre. So there's a real smart growth is called smart growth for a reason. You know, it's really, it makes a lot of sense to, and the good news is it's cheaper to, and from an infrastructure perspective, to, for the municipality to develop more densely. It's what people want now, and they want, you know, it's got to be well designed, it's got to be compact and walkable. But it makes so much more sense. There's a bigger return on investment, and the investment's actually less upfront for the town or the municipality.
Right, so and then there's the factor of it's local people spending their hard-earned dollars with local business owners who, all likelihood, live in the community. If they don't, their employees do, and then that money is getting spread back in. So it's the self-fulfilling kind of thing that's fantastic, and so much more to talk about, John. I hope you'll come back and visit with us when we have a little bit longer of an opportunity. But it was great to kind of get this crash course in this tax increment financing initiative, which was just approved by the Connecticut legislature, and to hear about some of the great work that's going on with Connecticut Main Street Center. John Simone is president and CEO of Connecticut Main Street. John, just hit him with the website one more time, and we'll say farewell to you for this morning.
ctmainstreet.org.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and don't necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.vocat, V as in Victor, O-K-E-T, at connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Vocat, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for another installment of the award-winning For the People, or listen to this and other For the People podcasts under the podcast tab on our station's website or on iTunes. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.